Welcome to the Bravo Dog Knowledge Podcast. I'm your host, Renee Erdman. I'm a certified dog trainer and behavior consultant and own bravodog.ca. I'm super excited for today's episode. I am talking to Thomas Aaron, who is what he calls a positive gun dog trainer, meaning he doesn't use aversives, talking about high drive dogs and how to work with them without food, surprisingly. Join us. I hope that you enjoy this as much as I enjoyed talking to him.
Welcome, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. It's Tom. It's Tom or Thomas? What do you prefer?
Thomas.
Aaron.
Yeah, Tom. Yeah. Either way. Just don't call me late for dinner. I'm good either way.
Fair enough. And you are from Fetch Masters. You're based out of Denver, Colorado. Thank you for joining us. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do as a trainer?
Sure. Yeah, thank you for having me. Before COVID kicked in, we trained probably 100 hunting dogs a year and probably 1,000 pet dogs a year. Our numbers are down a little bit. We're kind of rebuilding from COVID, but my company, Fetch Masters, has been around for 12 years. My wife, Linda, and I run it together, and we specialize in a number of things. What we call positive gun dog training. So training primarily upland hunting dogs without the use of e-collars and heavy-handed techniques and all of that stuff. We also do a lot of high-performance obedience type of stuff. A lot of people don't like the term obedience, but I want to kind of speak in a way that everybody kind of understands. So we do a lot of high-performance obedience in high-distraction environments, a lot of close proximity work to prey animals, which people have a lot of problem with here in this area. Do a lot of leash aggression work, stuff like that.
Nice. Okay. And you've been doing this for about 12 years. Did you start this training journey the same way that you are executing training now, or did you start using different methods? How's that?
Not even close. So to be honest with you, my first dog that I trained as a gun dog, I started off training her with an e-collar, and it became very obvious very quickly that was not going to work with her. She was way too soft, way too gentle a dog she couldn't take it. And I was, moderately skilled with an e-collar, so I wasn't just lighting her up, but she couldn't really handle it. And so that started my journey in sort of trying to reverse engineer a lot of these hunting dog manuals into something more positive. And I didn't know a lot about positive training at the time, but I joined the Animal Behavior College course, which was mostly positive. In the end, close to the end, it started getting a little bit balanced. But I have a massive group of colleagues here in the Denver area that are positive trainers. And so I had that influence, I guess. And over time, our techniques have been honed quite a bit. We've gone from knowing virtually nothing about it to being extremely positive in our training approach on just about everything. It's been a journey. That's why I tend to be very non-judgmental with people. If they don't see things the way I do, or they, they are taking a heavier handed approach, just try to show them a better way. Mm-hmm. It took me years to get softer and softer and softer too. So I try to go easy on people and just sort of help point them in the right direction, or at least what I think is the right direction.
Yeah. I don't think anybody changed another trainer's mind by arguing with them online about it.
Definitely not.
It doesn't work that way. We all have to come to our own conclusions on our own in our own time. So yeah, I think it's that's the way to go, is to continue doing what you're doing and showing just a different way of doing it. And sure. So tell me a bit about, so for people that don't know the difference between like working and hunting dogs from pet dogs, tell me, tell us a bit about the differences.
Well, I mean, within any litter of puppies, you're going to have a variety of personalities. Just because a puppy is born of a particular litter doesn't mean you know exactly what it's going to be. That said, genetics is very powerful. And so in general, a dog that is bred for hunting dog purposes typically is going to be a higher drive dog a lot of times. They're going to really be turned on by prey animals. They're going to typically have a really good nose. They're going to a lot of times have a more internal desire to retrieve, and what, you know, without it being something you have to teach them from scratch, they'll just kind of have the inherent propensity for it. And really that's what it comes down to, is propensities, right? Mm-hmm. The dogs just have certain characteristics that lend themselves to hunting birds, right? And, mm-hmm. and other small game in some situations, rabbits and whatnot. And so, you know, with a pet dog, I think that a lot of times the breeders focuses on, you know, creating a calm dog, a nice dog, a friendly dog, a social dog. With hunting dogs, we're not necessarily looking for calm a lot of times, right? We're looking for a dog that wants to get out there and get after it. And so it's, you know, you got to learn how to handle that sort of a mentality. A lot of times they have just a little bit more of a wound up mentality, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And does this make it more difficult for us to train them, especially for pet dog owners, you know, having a dog with high prey drive, as we often refer to it? Is there a difference between, you know, a dog that has high prey drive and one that wants to retrieve?
So I remember a long time ago, I love meat. I'm a meat eater, a hunter, and all of that. Brought home a 600-pound bull elk that I got during archery season. So I love to eat meat, but I love hamburger. And at one time in my past, I was on a diet and somebody suggested I eat veggie burgers. and the first thought that came through my mind was, this is not a hamburger. I didn't really like veggie burgers. I was like, this is an abomination, right? But then after a while, I actually got to like them, and I started to realize that the veggie burger is good in its own right. Mm-hmm. It's its own thing, right? It's not a hamburger, granted, but a hamburger is not a veggie burger either. They both have sort of their own thing, and sometimes to this day, I'll eat a veggie burger. It's not because I'm really replacing a hamburger with it. It's just right. Because I like the veggie burger. Well, when you're training some of these dogs that are, if you'll allow the term, that are of a bit of a wilder sort of nature, it's not difficult, in my opinion, to train them. Mm-hmm. That said, it's different sometimes. Like it's unlikely, and there'll be somebody in the audience that says, well, you know, my dog will call off of a rabbit for a treat, but most dogs won't, right? Yeah. Most dogs, a rabbit is going to be of much higher value than anything you're carrying around in your pocket. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of pet dog trainers, it's so easy on the pet dog side to make treats the primary reinforcer, mm-hmm. but to train a hunting dog or a hunting breed or any high drive dog, whether it's a Schutzen, you know, dog like a Malinois or something like that, or a German short haired pointer, any dog that's kind of driven, mm-hmm. Treats may not be the best thing. There's other things that you have to learn to use. Sometimes it's play or tug. Sometimes we find that the reward actually has to be things like letting the dog go out and sniff as a reward for it coming to you when you call. Or, you know, if you do what I say, you'll get a bird in your mouth, right? And so your mentality as a trainer has to actually shift a little bit. You need to be able to look at a dog and say, what does this dog want? And how do I integrate that into my training routines? And I think that's what the difference is I think that pet dog trainers understand this. What I'm saying, that every pet dog trainer out there with any level of experience is going to hear what I'm saying, and they're going to say, that's nothing new, we know that. That said, in practice, do they do it?
Yeah.
Right? And usually not. Usually for most trainers that I know anyway, in practice, it comes down to treats, and a lot of them will use play. But for hunting dogs, you have to expand out quite a bit in sort of a field environment, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I can say, speaking from my own experience, is that this is where I want to be able to grow more, because it's very difficult, if not impossible, with some dogs to be using food when they've got this high drive. And so, you know, there are some videos that you've got too of you working with dogs, quite puppies as far as I remember too, right? Building some engagement and reinforcement with like bumpers and things like that.
Correct.
Yeah. Is that, do you start with that by building some attachment to this, to toys and things like that?
Yeah. So when we're talking hunting dogs in specifically, you know, all of our early training is just like yours, right? It's going to be with treats. Treats are great for teaching most dogs to sit, to lay down, to come. But when you need something of a higher reinforcement level, if you will, higher value, sometimes you have to build that. And so, like, if I had my choice, if I have a German short-haired pointer puppy, for instance, I'm actually going to start way up front in the training, building enthusiasm. I like to say building drive, which is another term I've had trainers correct me on. But again, I like to talk in terms people can understand. But building drive or building enthusiasm for that bumper, I'll start that way early on. Like I typically don't give hunting dogs a lot of toys. They don't, if I can help it, they're not going to have a house with toys laying all over the place. The primary reinforcer is probably going to be that bumper. And for those out there listening who don't know what a bumper is, if you go to like Cabela's or Bass Pro Shop or something like that, the big orange cylindrical bumpers that you throw for a dog to retrieve, that's what we're talking about. I'll put it on top of the refrigerator. And whenever that dog wants to do something fun, I'll grab that bumper off the refrigerator, take it outside and retrieve with it and get it started on that. And then while the dog's still interested and having fun, I'll stop and go back inside and put it on top of the refrigerator again. And so by making the bumper sort of the only thing, or at least the primary thing, and not running it in the ground by boring the dog to death with it or going too long, you can build a phenomenal desire to retrieve. And that becomes a very viable reinforcer for almost any kind of training that we give for a dog for obedience or hunting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, we put a ton of effort into building retrieving drive.
Nice. Yeah. Well, and I think a huge concern for a lot of people is off-leash reliability. And that's often the reasoning for using e-collars outside of hunting, at least for pet dog. So what are your thoughts on reliability off-leash? How can people train that better with their dogs without using food? It probably is going to point to what you just said now that I'm thinking about it.
Well, actually I have a little different take on it. Okay. So to me, let's just talk. So when a lot of people say off leash reliability, what they really mean is this, that I can let my dog go run all over the place and quote unquote, just be a dog. But when I call him, he comes back. And to them, that's off leash reliability. Yeah. That I don't believe that. Now, for a super, super, super cooperative canine mentality, that may be fine. But for most dogs that we work with, that is not off leash reliability. That's not the way we look at it. I don't know that we could accomplish that. Mm-hmm. To us, off leash reliability is this: where I go, you go. When I turn U-turn when I give you an obedience command, sit down, come, stay, heal, fetch, then you do that. And you do it all within a certain perimeter of me. I don't let dogs roam out 100 yards from me. I usually keep them fairly close. So we do a ton of training on a long lead. So my point is this, is we're not trying to build recall outdoors. We're trying to build an overall mentality that you and me, you meaning the dog, right? You and I are together outdoors. It's not you outdoors and me outdoors and you come when I call. It's you and I are outdoors together, doing things together, moving in unison, working together. And you build this sort of mentality in a dog. That works a whole lot better with a young dog that is raised that way than it does with a dog that's currently, you know, psycho outdoors and trying to get it to come when called. So upbringing and controlling that dog's freedom when you're raising him pays very large dividends. And I like to explain it to people like this. Like if you have a Porsche, say you drive a Porsche and your child just turned 16 years old and got his learner's permit, you don't throw him the keys to the Porsche, right? You're going to give him the old Ford pickup truck, say learn on that, right?
Yeah.
That kid is going to have to grow in maturity and responsibility before you trust him with the keys to the Porsche. And I see it the exact same way with dogs. A dog is not extended freedom and then expected to come when I call. A dog is raised with a certain sort of code of a certain paradigm of what it means to be outside with me. And when the dog gets that, I will start extending freedom. So it's part of off-leash reliability is upbringing, if at all possible. The second part of reliability is habit, developing very, very strong habit. And a lot of people fall short in this. I read an article one time, and whoever wrote this article, you know, if they're listening to this podcast or ever run across it, I can't remember your name, but I would like to offer you a lot of praise for writing it because it was brilliant. And the title of the article was Train, Don't Test. And the thing a lot of people do is they'll do some training with the dog and then they'll test it to see if it worked. So let's say you train the dog to come when called and you train and then you take the dog and you cut him off leash and you call him to see if it's going to work. And the dog decides not to, and he runs off and does something else. So you just blew your training. Mm-hmm. It's better to train and just make training a part of your life with this dog. Then what happens is commands like here or come, stuff like that, they start to become so ingrained and habitual that they sort of gain an extra level of power. Just like I wake up at 6 o'clock every single morning, go into the kitchen, make coffee, sit down on my chair, look at my phone and drink my coffee. And if that doesn't happen in the morning, it feels like my whole day is blown. That, right? That's my habit. It's my pattern. It's who I am. It's gone beyond what I do, and it has become who I am. So you want recall and your other various obedience stuff and how we behave outside when we're outside together. You want that to not be what the dog can do. You want that to be who the dog is. And that's a function of training, not testing. And so really thorough training is important too. And, you know, to be quite honest with you, the shot caller goes around, is capable of going around this process, right? You teach a dog to come, and then you take him outside, and if he doesn't do it, you start to, you know, stimulate him with the shot caller, and he learns to come or else, basically come or else, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not that this stuff doesn't work, and nobody's saying it doesn't, but going back to my hamburger and veggie burger analogy, positive training, at least the way Fetchmasters does it, is not the same thing as a traditional trainer does, but different.
Yeah.
It's a different thing, right? Yeah. It's a different thing altogether. And we look at it through a different lens, if you will. There's a lot more to it. And to be honest with you, this is a very multi-layered process. But positive training, at least at high levels, it is a thinking person's game.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a one size fits all. And it's not a, you know, if you do this and you use this kind of treat, you reward your dog with treats this many times, it's going to work. Because it may or it may not. But I can tell you, like right now sitting in front of me, I've got three dogs. I've got a Labrador Retriever. She's 12 years old now, but she was a little bit younger. I've got a German short-haired pointer who is 7 years old, or who's 7 years old, and he is a wild child. Mm-hmm. And I have a coon hound that are very difficult to train to off-leash reliability. And all three of them are extremely, I would say, as near perfectly off-leash reliable as you're going to get. Why? It's not because they get treats whenever they do something, because I don't give them treats very much anymore. But they know what it means. It has become just like, think of it this way, just like me getting up in the morning and going in, sitting on my chair, drinking coffee and looking at my phone. It has become part of who I am. And in fact, it feels rewarding, meaning I like it. Okay. So when being outdoors with you and doing things in a certain way becomes who your dogs are, they like it. And so it starts to become a self-rewarding behavior when it gets to that depth. And so what I would say to positive trainers is don't go for breadth, go for depth, the depth of training. You don't want training that is a mile wide and an inch deep. It's far better to have training that's 5 feet wide and 20 feet deep. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I think a big challenge that, well, there, you know, one of the bigger challenges would be getting clients on board with that mentality. You know, I think that in this day and age, instant gratification is, I mean, that's where it's at, right?
You're absolutely right.
Your coaching skills, I mean, they've got to be on point with humans to wrap their head around this whole relationship that you're setting up with a dog.
You know, you're right. And the thing is when, like, we use all of our dogs for demo dogs, right? Whether it's pet dog training or hunting dog training, our dogs are always demo dogs. And people see this and they see the dog, the German Shorthair, running around in the field, you know, and he's a maniac. He's just a maniac, right? And yet, he's staying kind of close to me. He's not, I don't, like, I have horse fence around my property. Dog could easily go under it, right? It's not like a chain link fence or anything like that. It's just posts and rails, right? And so he's running around out there having a good time, looking for birds or rabbits or whatever is out there. He doesn't go past our rails and or our fence. And then when I call him, he comes running back and he's happy. And I pet him and tell him, good job. And we go on and we do some more. And people look at that and they go, holy smokes, that's amazing. How do you do that? And the answer is relationship.
Yeah.
This could, what I'm about to say could be taken wrong. It could be a double-edged sword maybe. But I think that by this time, people will probably understand what I'm saying. But relationship is our e-collar, right? Yeah. The relationship is our e-collar. That sort of unity that you have outside with your dog is our e-collar. And so when they ask how you do that, you go, relationship. And they go, well, what do you mean? And you start explaining it. People are like, I want that with my dog. So you got to get people away from thinking, I want my dog to do X, Y, and Z. And them handing you a checklist of things they want you to train their dog to do. And you got to get into a more of a holistic, unified mentality with them, right? Yeah, we can teach your dog to do anything. That's no problem. Almost any dog can learn to do any task. They're very smart animals. But getting the dog to want to do those tasks, that's a different story. And how do you do that? And I think it's a function of relationship, depth of training, the time you spend with your dog. And you know what? People want that. That's why they go out and get dogs in the first place. They don't go out and buy a dog in the midst of coronavirus because they want a checklist checked out. They don't want my dog to be able to do A, B, and C, so I'm going to go buy a dog. They want companionship. And I mean, I love the companionship I get with my dogs, but companionship, just like with people, it takes some effort, right? You don't go out and get married or find a significant other because you want somebody to do A, B, C, and D. Or if that's why you did it, it's probably not going to work, right? You go out because you want that companionship. And it's kind of the same thing with a dog. And so if you can get people thinking that way, the way I'm talking right now, it's really not that hard. I mean, we have a lot of clients, right? And they're doing fantastic with their dogs. My wife just took a video. So on our property, we have a lot of animals and stuff. And so we have baby goats. Now, I know all the women out there that are listening to this podcast, they hear baby goats and they smile. We have baby goats. And so one of our clients, she just finished level 2 obedience. Level 2, mm-hmm. Okay? It's not that far along. We have 3 levels, and she just finished level 2. And she has a lab, and the lab's out there running, chasing the goats. And the lady calls her dog, Murphy, come. Murphy stops and comes. Why? She didn't even give him a treat when he came. She just pet him and told him, good job.
Yeah.
Why is that? It was extremely positive experience. He doesn't have an e-collar, and he's not getting a treat. And he's not even particularly an overly praise-driven dog, although he does like praise. He didn't come for the praise. He came because that's what we do when we're outside together. That's what feels good. That's what's become habitual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I love listening to this because it does definitely reflect my belief and a lot of other people out there about the foundation of everything with your dog is the relationship, and you build upon that. And if you haven't spent the time building that with your dog, you're not going to have the responses that you're looking for.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what would you say to people then, that are thinking about getting a hunting breed or a pet dog? What can they expect? What should they be doing? And is it too late if they get an adult?
No, it's not too late. It varies from adult to adult. And like I said earlier, there are dogs born within the same litter with completely different personalities. So just because you have a breed doesn't mean that you're going to have all the challenges of a hunting dog. But I guess for the sake of this conversation, let's assume you do. Okay, let's assume you've just got a dog, an older dog, a younger dog, whatever. And it looks like it's going to be a crazy one. So what do you do, right? So, I mean, the first thing that we have all people do is create structure and restrict freedom right off the bat. And so that you can train. Like, you can't train a dog to come while it's out running, you know, half-cocked in the field. Mm-hmm. So we advise people to structure almost every aspect of the dog's life, because what you're trying to get through to this dog is this: here is the way we live our life together, right? Here it is. Here's how we live our life together. Here's where we eat. Here's where we go for walks. Here's our backyard. Here's what we do in the backyard. Here's what we don't do in the backyard. Here's where you sleep. Create structure. So a dog will feel comfortable once it understands, right? So structure is about creating a sense of understanding of its environment. You create structure indoors and you create structure outdoors. You do not want the dog to come to the conclusion that indoors the rules are A, B, and C, but outdoors it's a free-for-all. Mm-hmm. Right? You want structure indoors, you want structure outdoors. Once you've created structure, and the dog is not a 15-year-old with keys to your Porsche, then what you do is you begin training. And you don't just train indoors, you train outdoors. Everything you do indoors, you pretty much, well, as far as obedience goes, everything you do indoors, you do outdoors. And then you gradually extend the dog freedom as his training warrants it, mm-hmm. right? And you got to be careful, because there's people out there who they just want the dog, they want the dog to just be a dog, which is fantastic. But do you want your kid to just, do you want your 15-year-old with keys to the Porsche to just be a 15-year-old with keys to the Porsche? Right? So no, you don't want the dog to just be a dog. First, you want to create structure. You want to create a paradigm in which your dog knows how to behave inside with you and how to behave outside with you, right? Then you get that obedience training going, start building up actual skill sets, things that you want that dog to be able to do. And then you gradually extend freedom as the dog's training warrants it. Now, if you're getting a dog that already has a whole bunch of bad habits, that's okay, because is it going to be a little more challenging? Sure it is. But here's the thing. That dog is now with you, right? It was with somebody else, or it was in a shelter or whatever. Now it's with you. All of a sudden, my world has changed. Who are you? Where is this place? What do we do? I have a ton of questions. Help me answer them. And so your job is to answer that dog's questions, right? To create that structure, to create that training, to gradually extend the freedom. And the dog will take to it in most cases because everything's new, right? Now there's going to be times where he wants to revert back, but you need to be there to say, nope, that's not the way we do it. Here's the way we do it. Mm-hmm. And once the dog, I tell you, people talk a lot about really independent dogs, like German short haired pointers are a great example. And they say, well, you know, my dog doesn't want to do this. And in my experience, if a dog actually understands what you want and actually understands what the boundaries are and actually understands that staying within those boundaries is rewarding, most dogs, 95, 96, 97% of dogs in my experience will do what you want. But you got to take your time, right? This isn't this is building a marriage of sorts, right? Or a strong, close relationship of sorts. It's not just filling out a checklist of X, Y, and Z of what I want my dog to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you find that, so hunting dogs, if not given what they need, which we've just covered a lot of what their needs are and how to set them up for success, Do you find they have a propensity then to have things like anxiety and behavior challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. But let's be clear about what they need to do. Like people will think, well, if I have a hunting dog, I need to hunt with it. And that's actually not true. That's not the case. That said, the dog's fundamental needs, hunting is not necessary to fulfill a hunting dog's needs. Like, let me give you, I've got one trainer named Jessie, and she is a GSP fanatic. She has a crazy GSP, just like all the rest of us with GSPs. And, but she has multiple times, she has qualified for the Boston Marathon. She's a runner, right? So she goes out there and she runs with this dog and she gives this dog what it needs. She gives it the exercise. She's a training junkie like I am. So she's always training and teaching it new things. And, you know, she's mentally and physically giving this dog what it needs. Now, I want to point this out, though. There's a difference between what a dog needs and what a dog will do if you allow it to do. For example, I see people who with hunting dogs that will go out and they'll run, you know, 5 miles a day. Good Lord, I couldn't run 5 miles a day if I had to, right? But they'll go out and they'll run 5 miles a day with their dog, and their dog is still terribly behaved. Well, they're giving that dog what it needs, but that dog has figured out that if it whines and it paces and it does this and that, that it's going to get more. So she can never really fulfill that dog's quote unquote needs, because she's actually going beyond what that dog needs. And now she's getting into what that dog wants. And so here's the thing. My German short-haired pointer, who's a maniac, who's in the room with me right now, is laying on his bed sleeping instead of pacing and whining. Why is that? Because some dogs you need to teach. There is a time to go out and exert energy and be wild and free. And there is a time to lay down and calm down and be still because dad's got an interview to do. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a difference between what a dog needs and what a dog will take or wants or that kind of thing. So you gotta find some balance there, but yeah. And that goes back to the structure thing, right? That we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
It all comes back around.
That at a certain time of the day, or, you know, he can expect some exercise with you or some training with you, right? So he's not wondering when that's going to happen because he knows it is going to happen.
Right. And he anticipates, right? You know, he'll get whiny and pacey when he knows it's about time to go outside and do something. Like we do a morning walk around our property, and boy, he gets jazzed, right? Because he knows he's going to get to run rabbits down out of the property, and so he gets jazzed. Yeah. But right now he's sleeping, and so again, it goes back to the structure thing. The structure is there for a reason. Dogs need to know how things work, what you expect. If they don't know what you expect. And that you're pretty firm in that this is it, these are the boundaries, they'll blow through those boundaries. A lot of dogs will. Mm-hmm. So it's what I mean. It's a multi-layered thing. We're not training dogs to do things exclusively. We're training dogs to be our companions and to work with us and to live in harmony with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I see a huge opportunity if you aren't already, but offering some online courses to pet dog trainers like myself. And I know you guys do pre-COVID, you did seminars, correct?
Correct. Yeah. In 2016, I think my wife and I spent like 120 or 150 days on the road in our RV doing workshops around the country, that kind of stuff.
Wow. Are you going to offer anything online in the near future?
Well, I mean, we offer some online, we offer online coaching for our training clients. I'm sure we will. Right now, to be honest with you, we're just sort of just like everybody else getting through COVID-19 and, you know, trying to make enough money to not sink while we're trying to get through this, and we're doing okay, but
yeah,
I think once COVID-19's over, we'll stretch our wings out again. Right now we're just kind of circling the wagons and that kind of
thing. Well, and you do have, you've got some great videos, on your website, correct? And And what's your website address again?
We've got a couple of websites. So there's fetchmasters.com and then there's positivegundogtraining.com. Mm-hmm. Those are the two best ways for people to get a hold of us.
Okay. And then for trainers that have, maybe somebody, a client that's looking for this specific kind of, training, maybe it's out of their area of expertise, you are offering online training for those types of clients, right? So we can send them your way.
As long as we have the bandwidth for it, what I'll do is, so I'm kind of beating around the bush, but here's the thing. If somebody wants to train a hunting dog, there have to be certain resources available.
Yeah.
Right. You have to have the land for it. You have to have a place where you can shoot guns. You have to have access to game birds. Mm-hmm. If you're doing waterfowl hunting, you have to have access to water. And like out in my part of the country, not a lot of people, those stars don't align for most trainers. Right.
Yeah.
And so if a trainer thinks they want to help a person train a gun dog, the first thing they have to do is say, okay, do I have the resources to actually do this? Now, mm-hmm. if the answer to that is yes, I have the resources to actually do that, then what we'll do is we'll say, okay, you know, we'll help you out. We'll help you sort of work your way through this. We'll kind of tell you what to do. We have some online resources that we can show you, and we'll kind of give them some coaching as they move along with that client. To kind of help them help that client. But a lot of times trainers' hearts are in the right places. They want to help, but they just don't have the resources for it.
Yeah.
And in that case, it's kind of like, what do you do, right? I mean, you can't shoot a gun. You don't have a field. You don't know where to get birds. So it gets kind of tough. It's a tough niche for a lot of trainers because of that.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I think this has been a fascinating conversation, and I'm really appreciative that you took the time today to do this. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you wanted to add or tell
people? No, it's been a great conversation. Yeah, I appreciate you giving me the chance to get the word out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay, you too. Take care.
Take care.
If you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it, please go ahead and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That helps us continue to reach more people and their dogs. Don't forget, you can find us on Instagram @BravoDogTraining.